podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, which this week we're going to look a little bit at the state of England, looking ahead to the World Cup, and also later we've got a fascinating interview actually with a leading coach in the IPL, the South African Paddy Upton, and how he reflects the way that coaching has changed, especially in the one-day era, the way that coaching has evolved. Just before we get into our discussion, just a reminder that the new issue, The Cricketer, is out in 2 days' time, the June issue, which looks back at the first month of the county season and a little bit at the IPL as well, and it covers the whole gamut of what's going on in the world of cricket. And you can get your free issues of The Cricketer if you go to thecricketer.com/magazine, and there is a free trial offer there, so get into that as quickly as you can. We're covering England in that issue, and England actually have got one or two slight issues themselves coming into the World Cup.
It feels as if the countdown to the World Cup is beginning sort of in earnest now, doesn't it? The England players are gathering later this week in preparation for their matches against Ireland and Pakistan. The IPL players are just about finished now, some of them already back. Pakistan are on their way as well, saying that they think they've got all bases covered as far as the World Cup is concerned. I mean, the excitement is definitely building, although of course it's still another 5 weeks to go until the start of the World Cup itself. The weather seems to be playing ball, which is great for players who are preparing for the World Cup, trying to get into decent form. One or two issues for England. Jason Roy, he had that hamstring problem that brought to the end his Caribbean tour. Then he had back spasms in a recent one-day cup match. He came back to bat but didn't field. There's Alex Hales, who's not playing for Nottinghamshire at the moment for personal reasons. Chris Wokes, who knows quite where he is with that knee problem. He has been playing for Warwickshire, but his appearances have been limited. So just one or two issues for England. But of course, then there's someone like Johnny Bairstow, who's been in magnificent form in the IPL, which will be great for his confidence going into the World Cup, opening with Warner and producing all those incredible opening partnerships and just smashing it everywhere. So there are minuses and pluses, but it's still 5 weeks to go before everyone has to be in tip-top net for the start of the competition.
Moeen Ali actually.
And Moeen Ali, yeah.
Done pretty well too.
And eventually. I mean, slow start, but he's really come good.
Jofra Archer, who will obviously be playing some games in that one-day series against Pakistan. He's been in top form, bowled probably the quickest balls of the IPL so far, about 152 kilometres an hour, 93-94 miles an hour. I loved, actually, there was a Yorker he bowled to Hardik Pandya when the Mumbai Indians were looking really dangerous, and Hardik Pandya was just on the point of cutting loose in the first innings of the game. And he bowled this Yorker, the first ball of the last over of the innings, which, I mean, Wacko Yunis could not have exceeded it. It was just fantastic. 93 miles an hour, late in swing. It hit Pandya actually on the toe. In fact, I think he almost trod on the ball. And the only way of hitting that was to dig it out with a shovel. And he was LBW on review. I mean, if Archer can produce those, he's in my World Cup team for sure.
I was just about to ask you that. I mean, from what you've seen in the IPL, I mean, is he advanced his case in the last few weeks quite significantly?
Well, he certainly hasn't detracted from it. The trouble is, you only get to bowl four overs. You get to bowl quite often in three spells. And you don't really enable a bowler to build up any pressure on a batsman, because he bowls a few balls and then he's taken off and he comes back later. But I think that the way he bowls at the end is better than anything else England have got. It doesn't always work. It doesn't always come off. Occasionally, you do go for six. I mean, Rishad Pant hit him for a big straight six to nearly win the game the other night. But generally, he just looks in control and he's got something extra. So, yeah.
What about Ben Stokes' IPL? I mean, he clearly is going to be a crucial player for England this summer in both formats. I mean, I just wonder whether actually, I've sort of been mulling over this and thinking about the last few weeks, whether actually T20 is Ben Stokes is weaker suit of the three, that the more he's involved, i.e. you know, he gets the ball four overs or only bats for four or five overs, depending on where he bats in the order in IPL, so the less involved he is, then of course the least effective he is. He's one of those cricketers who needs 50 over cricket or needs test cricket to show off his full range of skills.
Well, I think,
or is he just still struggling at the moment?
Well, I think it is that if you look at the three different formats, test cricket, 50 over and T20, each of them is a slightly more extreme version, and therefore you get more hyped up, don't you? And test cricket, you know, the best test players generally, certainly batting wise, are the guys who are the calmest. And actually Stokes, in a test environment, just plays his natural game. They don't put men on the boundary very much, so he can play a naturally aggressive game and get boundaries. As soon as in T20, where he's already hyped up, they put men out on the boundary, and he thinks, well, the only way of me getting runs here is to hit balls over their heads, and he tries a bit too hard and just, you know, loses his shape and miscues it. So I think he puts himself under too much pressure to create an impact in T20 instead of perhaps just playing a bit more of a fluid sort of game rather than a power game. And bowling wise, you know, his bowling has gone downhill. I think his pace isn't great, and he hasn't taken any wickets, and he's giving away silly sort of full tosses, free hits, things like that, and he hasn't bowled about the last three games.
Yeah, well, eight matches for Stokes in the IPL. He's taken six wickets. He's only bowled 16.5 overs. He's gone for 11.22 runs per over.
That's a lot.
And he scored 112 runs, one reasonable score of 46, a strike rate of 125. He's not had the impact in the IPL that Rajasthan Royals were hoping for, expecting, really.
All paid for.
All paid for, yeah.
He did have an impact in the IPL 2 years ago, but he hasn't really been able to back that up. But hopefully in his home environment and in a 50-over concept, where I think his natural gifts will be more valuable, you know, he's not someone, I think, who can just come in and belt it. It takes a certain type of cricketer, an Andre Russell type, to be able to do that. You know, even look at Chris Gayle. Chris Gayle doesn't go in and belt it straight away, generally. He plays himself in and then unleashes. So I think Stokes has just got to get something in his head about playing in T20, just relaxing a bit more, actually, and putting himself under less pressure.
Well, that's the players. Let's turn to coaching now. Now, you have a theory about modern-day coaching, don't you, about how the start and the start of the 21st century is sort of split up in terms of eras of coaching.
Yeah, and I mentioned the word pressure there, and it's all about that, really. Certainly this modern era. Because if you look back, I think you can almost divide, let's say, the last 25 years into three groups of 8 years, glorified decades. The first decade, sort of just before the millennium, is the fitness decade, sort of from, let's say, 97 to 2007, say.
Where all the players got fit, where the coaches put the emphasis on fitness. We're going to be the fittest team. We're the fittest team, and at least that gives us a chance in those sort of marginal moments.
And nutrition came into it as well. A little bit about sleep, you know, just generally looking after your body.
Rehydration.
Better. Yeah, absolutely. Then from sort of 2008, beginning of the IPL, actually, for the last sort of 7, 8 years, it's been the data decade, where teams have really got into the analytics. Each team has an analyst. I was the only analyst once. Now there's hundreds of them. And you know, they all do their job of carefully following the game, monitoring the game, getting videos of the game, getting data sheets and Hawkeye printouts and so on for the batsmen and bowlers to follow particular plans and be quite sophisticated in how they apply those plans in individual matches, particularly in one-day cricket. So that's up to sort of 2017, 2018. And I think the next decade is going to be the mindset decade, because that's the one kind of frontier that a lot of teams and coaches haven't yet climbed over or overcome. How you deal with pressure, how you deal with those critical moments, how do you put out of your mind the importance of that moment? shutting the pressure out?
So, for example, in the World Cup coming up, there are going to be big moments in lots of games, and teams are going to stand or fall by what happens in those, what's referred to as clutch moments, aren't they? Those key deliveries, it might be a key over, it might be just a split-second decision that you take, whether to come back for a second or to just stick on one and try and get the runs on the next ball. It's those sort of things you're talking about.
And not trying to avoid the choking moments, which we obviously associated.
Like, for example, 1999 at Edgbaston, when there was that infamous run out involving Lance Klusener and Alan Donald.
Which you were commentating on.
Yeah.
They go for it. And Donald's run out. And Australia are in the final. The match has been tied. What a mix-up.
I mean, incredible moment, and you could just... It almost happened in slow motion. It wouldn't have felt like that for the two batsmen out there. It was unfolding slow motion cricketing disaster for South Africa. One in which actually still haunts them now, I think, doesn't it? And you know, it's something that is always labelled, always attached to the South African team, and they really resent it inevitably. But it's there. It's those sort of things you're talking about. Those sort of things we're talking about.
And I think the point we're making, in a way, is that teams have all caught up now. They've all got fit.
Yeah.
And they've all got the data.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got a data supplier and an analytics person, and they're putting it all together. And the teams are probably equally well prepared. And we're talking here IPL teams, we're talking international teams, even county teams have got. I mean, some of the counties actually are still behind, I think. But generally, professional cricket is professional.
Mm.
But what they don't have, many of them, is someone who can apply some mental knowledge, some real sort of psychology, to get them through those critical moments. And this is where Paddy Upton is interesting, because he's the one standout coach in the IPL, because all the others are quite familiar names.
Yeah, we've got Gary Kirsten, Ricky Ponting, Jack Callis, Mike Hessen, who perhaps not... I mean, everyone should know, really, in the world of cricket, but the former coach of New Zealand, he wasn't a standout player, but certainly did well with New Zealand as a coach. And there's Stephen Fleming, Jai Wardner, and Tom Moody. Those are the seven coaches of the IPL teams. And then there is Paddy Upton, who's the coach of the Rajasthan Royals, who comes at it from a completely different way.
Yeah, Paddy Upton's background is he was a player briefly for Western Province, and in fact, he made a century in his first-class game, and then only played one other, and then retired and became a strength and conditioning coach initially, and then went to become a mental and executive coach, and worked in business, actually, as much as he did in cricket, and worked with the South Africans, he's worked with the Indians, he's worked with various IPL teams before, but this is the first year he's head coach of an IPL team. He's written a book which is called The Barefoot Coach, which is out this week, actually, which kind of almost assimilates all his knowledge and learnings from the world of cricket and the world of business too, and the things you can do to perform better, both in work and in sport. So Paddy Upton sort of rather turned coaching on its head. If I go back to my career as a player, you know, there was only one method of coaching, and that was, you know, encourage people to go out and play well. But if you didn't play well, if you failed, it was quite a nasty atmosphere, especially if it was lazy or, you know, sort of error strewn. You know, we'd have naughty boy nets, we'd have the coach the next day whacking balls at us as hard as he could if we'd fielded badly, which practically ended up with broken fingers. It was a rather uncomfortable atmosphere. There was a fear of failure because of what would happen as a result the next day. And Paddy Upton doesn't have that approach at all. So let's hear what his philosophy is.
I'd almost put pressure and fear and failure, fear of failure. They're overlapping. They're not the same thing, but they overlap. And they are, in my experience, the two biggest obstacles to success. So pressure, the anatomy of pressure, is that the amount of value we place in the result is directly translates to the amount of pressure someone experiences. So why do people place a huge value on a result? So that's one of the places we can deal with pressure. So initially it's to devalue the result and bring the emphasis back onto the process. And we all understand that. Focus on the process, the result looks after itself. Don't focus on the result, focus on the process. It's easy to say, it's much more difficult to do in the high-pressure moment where results become consequential.
Well, also, because you're putting in so much resource into performance that it must be hard to devalue that performance when you've seen so much effort put into that performance.
So, no, we don't devalue the performance. We devalue
the
result.
I mean.
Yeah. It really is a fine balance. That's now getting into the fear of failure, is when players drop a catch, do badly, what happened last night, we blow out in the last three overs. How the leadership reacts in that situation determines the degree that which fear of failure will be experienced. So no one shouted, no one, you know, there was no carry on about that. There was just mature conversations around, so if you were in that situation again next time, there will be a next time, what would you do differently? So we talk about solutions as opposed to beat people up around.
Looking forward rather than looking back, maybe.
Very much so. And I mean, there's a very important psychology around dealing with errors, whereas if you look at what the problem in the past, it creates, it shuts down learning, it creates defensive attack mechanism, it pricks the person's ego, it undermines their confidence, and we actually know it also breaks the relationship down between the person, even if you're doing it with the best of interests. But if you were to look at, and the question that we ask here is, okay, if you were to, it's okay that you made a mistake, we're in the mistakes game. If you had that situation over again, what would you do differently next time? So we divert their attention to the future. They create solutions. And while they're creating solutions, it engages the creative part of their brain. It engages learning. It builds their confidence because they see themselves succeeding. And research even says that the relationship between the person helping them create the solution, that individual actually grows and trust builds. So how you relate to mistakes has a huge impact on a player's mental game. Now, it's amazing, even in the short space of time, that's how I always address problems with players. It takes them quite a long time, and 2 weeks to sometimes only in the second season, where players realize when they make a mistake, it's actually okay. They're not going to get beat up about it. They're not going to get spoken about in the coach's meeting behind their back. And they realize that it's actually okay to make an error. So I cannot now focus on not making mistakes. I can actually focus on chasing success.
Right, that's Paddy Upton, who's the coach of the Rajasthan Royals, the head coach of the Rajasthan Royals. The first time he's done that job this season. Now, they haven't gone very well, have they? Mm. They've struggled. Does it mean that it's not working, or is it you've got to give it time? And we'll look back in 10 years' time and say, actually, this man was a pioneer, or this man had really interesting ideas that everyone else has adopted.
Yeah, I think. Hopefully the latter, because I think he's a decent guy who's really studied the game very carefully and sport in general. I think he's hampered, actually, by having some players that aren't very good. And in the end, it doesn't matter how good a coach you are, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, can you? Mm. So there are players in that Rajasthan Royals team, especially in the bowling department, who just aren't really that good. And therefore, they're found out, no matter how effective the coach is at sort of saying, look, don't worry about failure, it'll be okay, it's not important, it's not a sort of criminal offence to lose, don't go and beat yourself up, but nevertheless, if you're not good enough, you're going to get beaten, aren't you? Yeah. So he's working with players that perhaps aren't quite good enough, or maybe they're not sophisticated enough to be able to impart his ideas.
Right, Sam, we've heard Paddy Upton's sort of general philosophy, his approach to coaching. What about his idea? I think this is really interesting. The World Cup's coming up. There are going to be some big moments, as we say. What about dealing with those really big moments, that one ball or that one over that's going to give you the World Cup or not? That if you like, that Edgbaston 1999 moment when South Africa were level with Australia and blew it.
Well, if you look at, and I don't want to sort of necessarily compare a World Cup final with a NatWest final, but that's the best experience I've got of playing in a one-day final at Lords, which, in the 1980s was a big moment. You had probably 7-8 million people watching.
Oh, they were really,
telly
they were really big matches.
Yeah, players playing and the full house and all that, and it was the sort of climax of the season. Mm. And you bowling the last over in those games, with 10 to win or 12 to win or whatever, I'd had no training at all. You just had to kind of believe in yourself and hope that it went well. And I think if
so
I look
no one talked you through a death over or anything
not at all. And you knew, and I mean Desmond Haynes, in fact, who played in one of those finals, reminded me afterwards that the difference between winning and losing was sort of 10 grand a player, something like that. So, you know, Desmond Haynes reminded me several times in the future. In fact, he continues to remind me that he'd planned to buy a spoiler and a new sort of set of alloy wheels for his sports car back in Barbados, and he had to bin them all once we lost this final against Warwickshire. So I cost him about 10 grand. And so that is in your mind when you're bowling that final over. And I think what, you know, if I look back at video of that, I rushed it. The best sportsmen in those critical moments seem to have a calmness, a composure about them. Obviously, MS Dhoni is a classic example. I think Joss Butler's actually a bit like that. Tiger Woods, you know, he famously, in his pomp, never lost a golf tournament when he was leading on the final day. And I remember Justin Rose telling me once when he played with him in the final round of a leading tournament, this is about 10 years ago, he said he was amazed that Tiger turned up on the morning of the final round and he was as cool as anything and chatting away, really casual, not taking too much time over his practice swings, playing a natural game for the first half of the round. He was really relaxed. And then once he was still leading the tournament, he really focused in that last sort of 7 or 8 holes.
I think I'm right in saying as well that England's penalty shootouts of World Cups and European Championships, just switch to football for a minute, is that when they timed those penalty shootouts, that England were taking their penalties quicker than other teams. It's the idea of rushing those big moments.
And you are, because you're in that sort of panic mode, very, very nervous, apprehensive, I think you do rush things, don't you? And that's not the way to go. It's all about trying to take a deep breath, trying to take it slow, almost trying to meditate. And clearly, Paddy Upton's attitude to this is to practice the panic moments that you're likely to experience. It's very hard to simulate the end of a match, you know, with 8 to 10 to win and, you know, 50,000 people screaming in the crowd. You can't really replicate that. Paddy Upton's philosophy is that you can practice to get into the right mindset to really deal with those critical moments.
We can practice every single aspect of cricket, except how do we practice that high pressure moment, recreate that high pressure moment, or recreate zoning, being in the flow, in the face of the distractions from that high pressure moment. We haven't been able to find that. And it's early days exactly how we apply it in cricket, but I have found what the neurophysiology is of that panic or choking moment, high pressure moment in a game. It's effectively a fight or flight response. We now can track exactly what happens when the amygdala in the brain triggers a fight or flight response. We know what triggers it. So now I've found a way through the science of meditation, what's happening in some other extreme sports, free diving, big wave surfing, what the extreme athletes are able to do, where their minds overcome their physiology and their body, so the mind over matter. But we can now see what happens in the mind when they do that. So we've found a way to recreate that at will, en masse, even just in a team room. It's very early days, so I don't want to talk in too much detail about it. You know, as the season unfolds, we'll see. But already I've been doing it for a week, and players are reporting some amazing things that are happening for them. But effectively what we're doing is, it's not sports psychology where we're fine-tuning players' focus or visualization under pressure. We're actually going in and neuro-hacking. So we're triggering the fight-or-flight response. And in a 15-minute training session, they trigger it 6 times. And in order to succeed, what the thing is, it's a trigger fight or flight response. Now, on a cricket field, a fight or flight response is always a false alarm, because it's a survival, ancient survival mechanism. On the field, it's triggered, and it's normally related to ego and what I look like if I fail, or desperation to succeed. So the fight or flight triggers, which shuts down our thinking brain, which is effectively the same as panicking. We focus on the problem, so we become distracted. We are not under any survival threat on a cricket field. It's a false alarm, and the survival mechanism is triggered to fire very early for our survival. So people who are able to, in survival situations, they endure these feats of physical endurance way beyond what any normal human being can, because they have to. But the reality is we need to learn how to override that early, number one, to false alarm. And on the cricket field, it is always too early, and it's completely false because there is no threat. So we found a way to trigger it, where players get into a mental, physical, highly stressed situation that is also a false alarm, and they learn how to become centered and zoned. So I can have 25 players, they do an activity that stresses them out, and I can see if anyone comes out of the activity, I know you've succumbed to your body or brain. And other players are able to hold it for longer. You have to be able to zone in order to override the stress signals from the brain and the body. And we can do that at will every day.
Okay, so you can practice, prepare for those big moments. He wasn't giving everything away there. Is there more you can tell us about this?
Yes. So he talks about fight or flight and panicking. And the way he's found to practice this is to get players sitting in a group or individually, mainly in a group, and holding their breath and see how long you can hold your breath for. Now, he stresses it's quite a dangerous thing to do if you don't know what you're doing. So this is not something to try at home without, you know, experienced people around. But apparently, and I've never tried this myself, but apparently you can suppress the urge to breathe. You can actually hold your breath for longer than you think. And you can train yourself to do that. And that's what, when he mentioned about these extreme sportsmen, that's what they are able to do. In fact, I was talking to someone the other day who said he's a very keen scuba diver and snorkeler and has trained his body to dive down underwater and hold his breath for over a minute. And other people he dives with can do it as well. It's training your body to do it. And they actually do it. Not only do they do this, Paddy Upton's protégés, not only do they do this in the hotel room or perhaps in the dressing room, but even in the swimming pool, they'll go underwater, certain players, and will try to hold their breath for longer than they think they need to and try and suppress that panicking urge to come up for air.
So how does that help you? Just to put that onto the field then, how does that help you when it is 3-1 off the last ball in a World Cup semi-final, or you're the bowler and you've got to hit your Yorker because they need 3-1 off the last over, or they need 6-1 off the last over?
I think it's close.
Last ball.
It's a good question, and it's close to meditation. It's trying to shut out the enormity of the excitement and the pressure of that moment, and just kind of almost retreat within yourself and realise that it's not a life and death moment at all. Don't panic. Take lots of deep breaths, or, you know, even hold your breath if you want. But just try and almost isolate yourself into that situation without all the extraneous stuff. And, you know, basically try and be calm. You know, don't panic is the sort of essential thing. But practicing to not panic, knowing that you can actually survive this. So calming yourself down, really lowering your heart rate, which I mean is a key thing, and then there's more chance of you being able to bowl that ball that you want to bowl.
So when you ran in that 1989 Cup final, was your heart pounding as you were running in?
Totally. And you know, everybody's nervous in big moments in sport. You know, schoolboys or schoolgirls will be playing, and they'll be nervous in their moments. You can overcome nerves by, you know, being calm and experienced and knowing that you can, in a way, you know, the key to overcoming nerves is knowing that you can do it. You know, knowing that it's okay to feel nervous.
Yeah.
But then the next stage, and this is what Paddy Upton's working on, is almost sort of suppressing those nerves physically as well as mentally.
Do you think someone like Josh Butler sort of does it instinctively? I mean, when he bats, you watch him in one day cricket and he seems to be ice cool. Is that the same thing we're talking about?
I think, but you know, certainly certain players have that naturally, don't they? You know, look at Owen Morgan. I mean, look at Dhoni. The other day, he needed 26 off the final over, and he nearly got it. I know, you know, in the end, he actually failed, but he probably was almost too relaxed, sort of thing. So, you know, he got 24, and then the last ball, they got run out, so he didn't manage to achieve it. But there clearly are players who just have it naturally, and... you know, actually, I've talked to Paddy Upton about it, and he says it's almost close to being psychopaths. Almost, you know, psychopaths have this, you know, almost this ability to suppress any kind of nerves or anything. And the psychology of players who have this ice in their veins is sort of almost related slightly to psychopaths, which is a slightly alarming thing to think, but there is a psychological parallel.
Well, that's the challenge for all the players in the upcoming World Cup, isn't it? To be able to just control themselves in those really big moments.
Totally.
Of which, of course, there will be many. Well, so you think that the mental side of the game is going to be the next big thing in the next sort of decade or so? I mean, is it not already part of the game?
I think it is already part of the game. And
but it's not as all-pervasive as data and fitness, because they are just givens now, aren't they?
I think the mental part of the game hasn't yet become... so integral, because no coach or few coaches have really managed to master how to pass on this stuff. You know, it's close to neuroscience, and there aren't many coaches who are neuroscientists, but clearly Paddy Upton's getting there. In the end, you've got to have the players, and if you haven't got the players, it doesn't matter what you do neuroscientifically, they're not going to be very good. But if you've got players who are prepared as well as they can be, and they're also, you know, trained physically and scientifically with all the data, they're almost on the same sort of part. They're almost on the same playing field. How do you find the next level? This is it.
Mm. So it's about
5%.
Those little percentages, isn't it, that can turn a losing team into a winning team.
And look how close a lot of these one-day games are now. You know, one or two balls, one or two runs can decide them.
Yeah. I mean, you always think when it's a really close finish, team wins by 3 runs, you think, or sometimes a team that is, the chase seems a long way away, and then ultimately you get within 5 runs or 7 runs, and you think, well, just look back somewhere early in the game, or, you know, something, you know, it's probably a one or two balls earlier in the game that if that had gone our way. Anyway, I know that is all ifs and buts. Well, fascinating stuff.
I mean, a lot of it's over my head. So we'll keep on the case here and trying to see how it evolves. But be interested to hear from any of you at home, you know, when you're listening to this, what your view on overcoming these pressure moments is. There may be sports psychologists amongst you. So please write in and let us know what you think. The email address is theanalystpodcast@gmail.com, and anything that you have to say about this subject or any other subject would be gratefully received. Actually, it'd be great also if you'd review this podcast on iTunes, because we haven't had any reviews for a while, and they're always pretty good, and it's nice to see some feedback from the listeners so we know what to talk about.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this episode of The Analyst Inside Cricket, tell someone else, because they might do so as well.
Yeah, so thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Bye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.